For our audience of blind and print-impaired folks, your North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week magazine, dated November the 10th, 2021. And I'm John Federson, reading this weekly issue from the print and the online Indie Week, joined briefly by our musicians today from the planet Skulsk. They call themselves Zygon the Invincible and Lurline. That's this creature's earthly name. They don't have an alphabet on that planet. And hopefully they'll materialize in about an hour when our broadcast is ending. First off, a story from that's probably on the national news today, the 11th of November, which concerns the Leandro state judgment against North Carolina for underfunding education. And this story has been in the news in various ways for 25 years. Superior Court Judge David Lee said the state's children can no longer wait to receive the sound basic education the state's constitution guarantees. The court, he said, has waited 17 years for the General Assembly to meet that constitutional mandate. The court's deference is at an end at this point, said Lee. Now, Lee's order won't go into effect for 30 days. And what is that order? It's to order lawmakers to take $1.7 billion from North Carolina's $6 billion or more savings account to pay for the next 2 years of a comprehensive public school improvement plan. The order won't go into effect for 30 days. The state's Republican-led General Assembly contends Lee doesn't have the authority to force lawmakers to spend money and will likely contest the order. House Speaker Tim Moore, Republican from Cleveland County, called Lee a rogue judge. Quote, Special Superior Court Judge David Lee has signaled his intent to circumvent the authority of the General Assembly by ordering the transfer of funds outside the appropriations process. Judge Lee's actions would be a clear violation of the North Carolina Constitution. Lee said the focus must remain on the state's 1.5 million K-12 students, saying this case is not about the judge, the legislature, it's not about the attorneys, it's about these children and what's going to be necessary to achieve the Leandro mandate education in this state. He also said the state constitution gives the courts the authority to act when other branches of government fail to meet their constitutional obligation. That point was made earlier this week by State Attorney General Josh Stein, who issued a memorandum of law on behalf of the state affirming the court's authority to issue such an order. Stein wrote, citing Green versus Ure from 1975, if there exists a conflict between legislation and the Constitution, it is acknowledged that the court, quote, must determine rights, liabilities, or duties of the litigants in accordance with the Constitution, because the Constitution is the superior rule of law in that situation. Moore was critical of Stein's memorandum, quote, the North Carolina Constitution gives the General Assembly the exclusive authority to appropriate funds. Any attempt to circumvent the legislature in this regard would amount to judicial misconduct and will be met with the strongest possible response. Judge Lee has been overseeing the state's landmark school funding case, Leandro versus the state of North Carolina, that was brought by 5 school districts in low-wealth counties that argued their districts did not have enough money to provide children a quality education. In 1997, the state Supreme Court issued a ruling, later reconfirmed in 2004, in which it held that every child has a right to a, quote, sound basic education, that includes competent and well-trained teachers and principals and equitable access to resources. Shanika Pender, an original plaintiff in the lawsuit, applauded the order, saying this is one change for North Carolina to properly fund education and give it the priority it deserves. The children of North Carolina deserve this constitutional right. Our future depends on it. Judge Lee hired West Ed, an independent consultant, to develop recommendations to improve North Carolina public schools. The improvement plan before the court is largely based on the West Ed report. The recommendations include staffing each classroom with a competent, well-trained teacher, staffing each school with a competent, well-trained principal, and identifying the resources to ensure all children have an equal opportunity to obtain a sound basic education, among others. Lee said he doesn't know of any other plan developed by lawmakers to address the constitutional mandate. He noted that the state has the financial wherewithal to easily pay for the next 2 years of the Leandro Comprehensive Remedial Plan, submitted to the court in March and signed by Lee in June. Many of the recommendations in the comprehensive plan target children at risk of academic failure, Lee said. Quote, this case is about children who are from high poverty, low performing districts in the area of our state who are not given a fair opportunity to get a sound basic education. Unfortunately, from the numbers I have seen, the sheer numbers of those students has increased dramatically and continues to do so. So, in that sense, it's a runaway train. Mary Ann Wolf, president and executive director of the Public School Forum of North Carolina, said Lee's historic order provides critical investments for students and schools that will ultimately flow to communities and our economy, saying, quote, this includes research-based investments in human resources, greater access to educational opportunities, and improvements to the accountability and finance system that impact education every day. The people of North Carolina made a commitment to a sound basic education for each student by way of our state's constitution, and these investments ensure that our schools and students have what they need to reach their potential. Now, affordable housing articles. The first from Cary. The Cary Town Council unanimously approved a plan to increase affordable housing during its Tuesday meeting. The question is, how will it be executed? The plan includes 22 ambitious action items designed to increase the supply of affordable housing. It was met with widespread support from residents as well as nonprofits working to house people at lower incomes. Stephen Walker, who lives near downtown Cary off Park Street, said, if you drive through my neighborhood, you'll see the problem. Lot after lot has been razed. Massive houses have come up. We need balance. We need to understand that a healthy town is diverse. Cary employees and first responders deserve to live where they work, Walker said. Jackie Ayala, advocacy director for Habitat Wake, agreed, saying, today there are thousands of people who work to make Cary a great community to live in but can't afford to live here themselves. Ayala was enthusiastic about three specific goals in the plan, the creation of a home ownership program, ideally down payment assistance for people making less than 80% of the area median income, she said, the construction of affordable housing on town-owned land, and the creation of a housing fund. The question is, where will the money come from? Cary's housing plan includes a lot of progressive goals, including relieving the financial burden on seniors and supporting nonprofits in their work to house people. The plan also outlines new programs that could help stabilize the housing market, like a low-interest loan fund for landlords to make repairs to rental housing, and an emergency housing program to keep residents affected by a crisis in their homes. What's unclear to some advocates, however, is how and when these plans will be put into action. Several suggested using a penny tax, similar to the one enacted in Apex, to create a dedicated funding stream for affordable housing. Pastor Wesley Spears Newsom, a member of nonprofit One Wake, said, we believe a penny for housing plan would greatly benefit our town in Cary. I love this plan, and I hope we can muster the financial strength to make it a reality. Beth Bordeaux, an affordable housing advocate, agreed, saying she and other members of a volunteer group advising Wake County are encouraging cities and towns to enact a 1.5-cent or similar tax for affordable housing. In response, Mayor Pro Tem Don France said the town is already committed to spending more money than a 1-cent tax would raise. He said the council has proven they have the political will to support affordable housing and increased development despite objections from some residents. France said, "We are going to put our money where our mouth is, I promise you. Every single one of us is committed to dealing with this." And that article was written by staff writer Jasmine Gallup. Somewhat related, a column from Durham by Tomasi MacDonald, A Social Contract. Alex Perlman, a volunteer organizer for Bull City Tenants United, a local organization of renters who want to build tenant power and put an end to eviction, has his fair share of landlord horror stories. For 5 years, he lived in an apartment with a major roof leak. He told Durham's city council members at a virtual work session last week. The landlord refused to make repairs, Perlman said, but would spray the roof with a thin sealant every 3 to 4 months. He said, the sealant would last about 2 hours worth of rain, and then it would start raining throughout the apartment. Perlman, a Durham Tech student who works as a nursing assistant at UNC Hospital, said that over time he and his roommates feared being electrocuted, so they would minimize their use of electricity when it rained. Worse, while Perlman and his roommates suffered from asthma attacks, respiratory infections, constant fatigue, and unexplained rashes, they realized the roof had become a mold factory. Perlman said laws that allow mold to go unaddressed were, quote, a failure of public health officials, because controlling for the substance is, quote, not a part of the public health code. Durham city and county leaders readily acknowledge that addressing the rise in violent crime and keeping communities safe are top priorities. But with soaring rental and home prices, perhaps the greatest existential threat moving forward remains the question, who gets to live in the Bull City? Last week, the council members referred a list of recommendations from Bull City Tenants United to the city's manager and deputy city manager that proposes to shift the balance of power in landlord-tenant relationships. The city is seeking legal expertise before crafting a tenants' rights bill, a concept that was first introduced to the city council in early August by council member Didriana Freeman on behalf of the tenants' rights group and housing advocates. The need to protect tenants' rights came to the forefront amid growing concerns about the end of the blanket federal moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. There were 13 recommendations submitted to the council as a means of protecting residents, but a number of the proposed measures are preempted by city law, says City Attorney Kimberly Rayburg. For instance, Rayburg points to a 2019 state legislative bill that would have allowed city and county officials to, quote, repair, close, or demolish a dwelling deemed unfit for human habitation due to fungal growth, mold, that poses a health risk. And Housing Bill 1012 never made it out of committee. Likewise, Rayburg noted that state law prohibits local governments from regular mandatory inspection of rental units unless it is for, quote, a reasonable cause or part of a targeted area to address blight. However, the city attorney wrote, state law does not make clear whether a tenant can withhold paying rent until repairs are made in the unit where they reside. Rayburg said that Charlotte has a provision in its city code that makes it unlawful for the owner of a place of habitation that it is imminently dangerous to health or safety to collect rent from the occupant of the residence at the time it was imminently dangerous to health or safety. As the Indy previously reported, there is a forced, ongoing exodus of working-class African-Americans from Durham's inner city, driven by skyrocketing property taxes, an influx of new homes that are far beyond their financial reach, and neighbors who no longer look like them. They're selling their homes to developers and individuals for above, but not far above, market value. The issue becomes even more complicated by the arrival of comparatively affluent newcomers who are looking for places to live during a citywide housing shortage. It's a seller's market, and rental prices have soared far beyond what even those making a living wage can afford. Today, the average rent for a Durham apartment is just over $1,400 a month. According to the Living Wage Calculator for Durham, An adult with one child would have to earn a yearly income of $55,155 to afford it. Here in Durham, often touted as a mecca of black history, arts, culture, and inclusivity, a little over 21% of African Americans live in poverty. Trying to make ends meet is even more dire for Latinx residents. More than 31% live below the poverty line. By comparison, just under 8% of whites in Durham live below this poverty line. As a consequence, Durham's black and brown residents struggle to stay afloat and scrape up the financial means to rent substandard dwellings that fail to meet basic quality of living standards. Those dwellings include places like the Garden Terrace Apartments in Lakewood, where many of the residents are Spanish-speaking. Inspectors with the city's Neighborhood Improvement Services Department visited Garden Terrace late last year and found 120 housing code violations. Despite the harrowing outlook, Stella Adams, a nationally recognized expert on the Fair Housing Acts and former executive director of the NC Fair Housing Center, reminded the council members of their ability to address the city's housing crisis, which impacts its most vulnerable residents. Adams' case in point was the public health crisis that happened at the city's oldest public housing complex months before the pandemic. It was in early January 2020 that gas leaks, mold conditions, lead paint, pervasive sewage issues, and the unexplained deaths of three infants at McDougal Terrace reached a tipping point. By the end of that month, the Durham Housing Authority reported elevated levels of carbon monoxide in 211 kitchen appliances after inspecting 346 apartments. And Adams told the council, "We had our public housing residents living in unaffordable conditions, unsafe conditions, with stoves that are 70 years old, endangered every day, and yet that's public housing, that's public money. One thing the city doesn't need the state or federal government to do, anytime a city dollar is spent on a property, you require an assurance and certification that is kept in a safe, habitable condition. If not, you can force those city dollars to be returned. That's something you can put in the contract." Howard Machtinger is a policy team member of Bull City Tenants United. During the work session, he said the purpose of the recommendations is to support the city's renters, quote, in the long and short run, who are facing multiple crises, including rampant gentrification and pending eviction. He told the council members already there are over 700 evictions since the moratorium ended, with rising rents and homes in disrepair. Machtinger, who previously served on a housing subcommittee of the city's Racial Equity Task Force, said contracts between landlords and tenants in North Carolina swing strongly in favor of the landlord. He explained, "We want to shift the balance of power in this landlord-tenant relationship and expand the tenant's rights. For instance, when we shop for toys or food, there are assurances that the items are not toxic. What assurances are there for our close and intimate living spaces? Everyone in town is aware of the diminishing affordable housing. This is a snowballing crisis dramatically exacerbated by the pandemic, so the time is now. Tenants' rights is one key for action." Five of the recommendations by Bull City Tenants United call for an expansion of housing codes to make sure the city's renters are living in habitable homes, along with expanding the city's use of emergency repairs when landlords are unresponsive, preventing landlords from charging for rent when their units are in disrepair, expanding access to home inspections, particularly when language barriers arise, and ensuring the availability of interpreters, and providing city support of tenants' rights to organize. Machtinger said, "We understand that much needs to be done on the state level, but the city can and must do more to help tenants and provide affordable housing." Prohlman, the Durham Tech student and organizer, also told of a family of six living in a two-bedroom apartment in the Lakewood district. This family, he said, went weeks that turned into 3 months before the landlord decided to replace a stove and the refrigerator that had both gone out. "Can you imagine," he asked, "trying to feed 6 people under those circumstances? How would that make you feel as a parent?" This is the kind of passive violence that must be aggressively penalized by the city. It's not okay for landlords to get a slap on the wrist for making people live like this. Bowman later added that, quote, "functional kitchen appliances must be a part of the housing code, and right now they are not." Council member Mark Anthony Middleton echoed a unanimous sentiment among his fellow council members when he said that in addition to this bring a policy issue, it's a moral issue, decent and safe housing. While wondering about the city's legal authority to adopt the recommendations, Middleton said he wants, quote, "as robust and impactful an ordinance as we can deliver, whatever it looks like, in every area we can." At the end of a nearly hour-long discussion, City Manager Wanda Page told the council members that she and her staff members had listened, taken notes, and wanted to review point by point the tenant group's recommendation. She promised to return to the council, quote, "with more research and a comprehensive response." From Chapel Hill, Lee Toss' article, "Is Chalt Dead?" For the last 3 election cycles, nearly every candidate endorsed by Chapel Hill's notoriously anti-development community group, CHALT, the Chapel Hill Association for a Livable Town, won election to local office. That ended last week. Mayor Pam Heminger handily defeated CHALT-backed candidate and town council member Hongbin Gu, and 3 pro-growth candidates won seats on the council. Only 1 CHALT-endorsed candidate, Adam Searing, made it onto the council, and he received the fewest votes. Former Orange County Commissioner Mark Macropoulos said CHALT took a gut punch in this election. It could be the beginning of a new era here. For those paying attention, the signs were all there. No, we're not talking about those anonymous political signs accusing Karen Stegman of betraying residents with her vote for the Aura development, which CHALT denied putting out. CHALT's power and influence was waning. Criticism was mounting over the group's allegedly divisive political tactics, and a new progressive agenda promoting a denser, more walkable town was gaining popularity. A recent survey from Public Policy Polling also indicated CHALT's apparent decline. Just 26% of participants reported having a favorable view of the organization. 40% claimed to have an unfavorable view, and 34% responded not sure. Heminger says, "I think this election really showed people are seeing a different path forward. They want Chapel Hill to become vibrant. They are interested in bikeways and greenways and interested in how we can recreate that middle housing." Heminger secured a 4th term in mayor with 61% of the vote to Goose 37%. UNC Chapel Hill Law School student Zachary Boyce won 2.5% of the vote. In the council race, the top vote-getter was Stegman, possibly boosted by that backlash garnered from the anti-Aura signs. Stegman, Camille Berry, and Paris Miller-Fouché received about 20% of the vote each. Searing hung on to 4th place with 17%, edging out the CHALT-backed candidate Vimala Rajendran. Stegman says the results were vindicating. Voters, she says, are tired of the same old. People are craving, especially after the last 2 years of living through a global pandemic, they're craving connection, authenticity, and cooperation and collaboration. CHALT was formed in 2015 by a group of citizens dissatisfied with the town's leadership at the time. They felt neighborhood issues were being overlooked, and members promoted themselves as environmentalists. Founder Julie McClintock would tell you CHALT's members aren't against the town's growth, but want Chapel Hill to grow in the right way, a way that preserves, quote, what people love about the town and not just add more people. McClintock didn't respond to the Indy's request for comment on the election, but took an optimistic tone in an op-ed published on chapelboro.com, writing that, quote, elections ebb and flow, and there are many measures of success. She praised Gu's mayoral campaign and Searing's election to council and wrote, We're looking forward to building bridges and sharing what we're about to the community. Discussion took a less congenial tone on neighborhood networking site Nextdoor, where one supporter spiraled into a rant that was shared on social media. The election night comment, "Chalt is not dead. This is not a sprint." The post went on to state that Chalt's opposition took a few pages from the GOP and Nazi handbooks. That kind of rhetoric is what's sown a new level of divisiveness in Chapel Hill policies, Markopoulos says. He says he hopes the new council will be one with a shared vision rather than divisiveness and tribalism dominating the debates. And as for Chalt, Heminger says, I don't know what they do to regroup at this point. Another article by Tomasi McDonald, this time from the online IndyWeek.com. North Carolina Central researchers report fewer people in the county jail, but they're locked up for a longer time. The study also finds that the county's black residents accounted for a disproportionate percentage of the jail's inmates. The NC Central researchers found that while admissions to the jail had declined by 25% over the study period, the average length of time in custody increased by 24%. Made public this month, the report Understanding Trends in the Jail Population in Durham, North Carolina, 2014-19, was done in partnership with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Its analysis is based on data accumulated during the tenure of the county's former district attorney, Roger Eckholz, who was first elected in 2014 and left office in 2019 when he was defeated the year before by current district attorney Satana DeBerry. DeBerry campaigned on a promise to fundamentally change the way the county's criminal justice system operates by addressing mass incarceration, jail overcrowding, and racial disparities. She told the Indy this week that while most of the study period in the report did not take place during her tenure, the researcher's findings are in line with her office's goal of focusing on serious offenses. She said in an email, "In a system focused on violence, we would expect to see longer stays and higher bonds for serious cases, with fewer admissions for lower-level cases." The decline in the jail's population during the study period, quote, is good news and makes a tremendous difference in the lives of Durham residents, DeBerry said. Most people come in contact with a criminal legal system because of a minor, nonviolent offense, and detaining them pre-trial away from their jobs and families can do more harm than good for our community. On the other hand, DeBerry added that everyone in jail is not awaiting their day in court for a resolution of their case. The DA explained about factors that could affect the average length of time someone spends in jail. Some individuals are serving misdemeanor sentences, haven't been transferred to prison yet post-conviction, or are being held on detainers related to federal prosecutions. We're seeing more individuals being held post-conviction or on detainers recently. Other factors, including serious of the offense, an individual's prior criminal record, and how long it takes to resolve a case. The research team, again from NC Central, points to another likely reason for folks spending more time in jail: crime and law enforcement's response to violent crime. The researchers point to data showing that Durham's crime rate is higher than state and national averages. The study also determined that violent felonies were, quote, the least frequent admissions type into the center and remained below 8% across all years of the study period. Not surprisingly, the study said, individuals charged with violent felonies were also more likely to spend more than 90 or more days in jail. Lastly, those who were admitted to jail in the past 3 years were more likely to spend more than 90 days in jail. DeBerry noted that the report indicates the decline in the jail population has been fueled by an across-the-board reluctance among judicial officials to put someone in jail for minor, nonviolent offenses. In early 2019, DeBerry and county judges adopted a new pretrial release policies. She said that the DA's office policy, which guides the recommendations prosecutors make to judges, discourages the use of money bail and pretrial detentions in cases where public safety is not at risk. She noted that when the pandemic began, her office partnered with defense attorneys and judges to safely reduce the jail population to mitigate spread of COVID-19. Researchers found that in 2014, the detention center's average daily population of 521 people was down to 423 in 2019. DeBerry said the jail's daily population average reached a low point of 240 by July of last year, months after the onset of the pandemic. She added that jail's current population, which includes people being held post-conviction and on felony charges, has, quote, gradually returned to pre-pandemic levels. The researchers also found that the county's black residents accounted for a disproportionate percentage of the jail's inmates. African Americans make up about 37% of Durham's population, but account for just under 70% of all jail admissions during the study period, and consumed well over 70% of the beds used. By comparison, whites make up about 43% of the population and about 16% of jail admissions. Black people were also on average spending more time behind bars at the county jail. The researchers said almost 3.5 more days in jail compared to white people. "That's a very big question," DeBerry replied when asked about the overrepresentation. "In the most immediate sense, it's driven by racial disparities in arrests. More broadly, though, it's driven by long-term disinvestment in black communities and systemic racism in our laws and criminal legal system." DeBerry pointed to the North Carolina Central Research, which notes that racial disparities in the jail population remained, quote, fairly consistent during the study period, despite declines in admissions. "This is concerning," DeBerry said, "and suggests a need for policy changes that directly address racial disparities." Now, Mona Dugani writes for IndyWeek, "Support systems. Asheville, Charlotte, Durham, Greensboro, and Raleigh are starting to see Afghan refugees who were displaced from their home country in August resettle in North Carolina. As they arrive, other Afghan residents already in the state have lessons to share about some of the mental health challenges that often accompany refugees fleeing turmoil who are suddenly thrust into a new life in a foreign place. Since the Taliban overthrew the Afghan government on August 15, and U.S. troops withdrew from the country 15 days later, many who had lived in the country and fled for safety reasons are being dispersed around the globe. But a larger exodus from Afghanistan has been going on for two decades now. Over the years, roughly 6 million Afghans have been forcibly displaced from their homes, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Of these 6 million, about 3.5 million are still living in Afghanistan, while 2.6 are refugees living around the world. North Carolina is expecting around 1,200 refugees in this most recent wave. Amina, a refugee who came to the Triangle nearly a year ago, said though the journey was difficult with the language barrier, she felt that she had support. She says, "I got help with finding a job, English classes, finding school for my kids, and my husband was able to find mental health services," she told North Carolina Health News in an interview in Farsi, the Iranian language. Images of war and, excuse me, Afghanistan language. Images of war and violence were haunting her husband. He left Afghanistan with the family still there. Though Amina left family behind too, she has been overwhelmed by the support she has found in Raleigh. The U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, a nonprofit organization that set up an office in North Carolina in 2007 to provide support to refugees in their transition to life in this country, has been helpful. Amina also found support and work at Designed for Joy, a nonprofit in Raleigh that hires and helps women who come from vulnerable situations. At its new shop near the city's warehouse district, the organization also sells earrings, necklaces, bracelets, and other gifts. All women stitch together handbags and more in a room attached to the store. In the evenings on Monday through Thursday, when Amina is not hard at work making handbags, she takes English classes. She does all this while also tending to her four children, who range in age from toddler to teen. But memories of war are always a stressor lurking in the background. The ongoing war and violence in Afghanistan over the past two decades has taken a serious toll on the mental health of Afghan residents and refugees in this country and elsewhere. According to a 2019 article from Human Rights Watch, about half the Afghan population experiences post-traumatic stress, anxiety, or depression. Khadija Bahari, an Afghan woman from the Hazara ethnic group who moved to this country in 2005 and now lives in Virginia, often speaks about seeking equality for women in Afghanistan. In a recent telephone interview, Bahari said, "It has been hard to watch and read the news about the Taliban takeover of the government." She said, "I feel terrible. I feel very painful. I can't describe when the Taliban was moving forward, taking over. I was very much in fear and shock. Nothing is good," she added. "Every day there's bad news. Not one bad news. Several bad news." Though the news has been disheartening for Bahari and other Afghans, she's focusing on what is working for her. "I mean, I have a good life," she said in August. "I have a husband that I love. I love my job. I love my family. I have great friends and support. The best thing I can do is to read the news less and stay away from reading the news." For someone like me, who was involved in Afghanistan's social activities, it's hard not to in this critical moment, and not to look at the news and to see what's going on. Some people don't seek professional help to soothe anxiety and mental stress. Bahari, who understands some of the challenges and disparities that her ethnic group faces in Afghanistan, has found support among other Hazara women. In recent months, they got together and lamented that Hazara Afghans do not seem to be able to leave the country as easily as some of the other ethnic groups. Although Bahari has a support system of her own, she questions whether the most recent arrivals from Afghanistan will have sufficient resources, saying, "I don't think there are very many sources. Lots of people, maybe 90% of these people, cannot speak English. They're coming from rural Afghanistan with those mentalities, and it's all shocking. Even the good things in the U.S. are shocking for them. They have to go through adjusting to a new culture. So I don't think there are enough sources, in my opinion. There are, but very limited, because all these people need interpreters to translate for them." Adam Clark, director of World Relief Durham, a refugee resettlement agency that helps with school enrollment, housing, job hunting, and more, said the language barrier can sometimes make it difficult for new refugees to access mental health services. And he said, "What we're seeing on the news, what Afghans are going through, is unfortunately very common for all refugees coming from all the nations that send refugees to the United States. For decades, there's been very little access for them to mental health services. The current Afghan evacuees will face the same barriers that all refugees face in the United States, primarily around language access, but also having sufficient health insurance. In general, they're just a marginalized population that does not receive as much access as others to mental health support." In an attempt to help refugees access mental health services since 2015, World Relief Durham has been partnering with the UNC School of Social Work on the Refugee and Mental Health Wellness Initiative. And Clark said, "By partnering with a university and professionals in the mental health industry, we're tapping into trauma-based counseling and trauma-informed service training for all our team. We're able to provide services that are not available to most resettled refugees because of that partnership and our work with them. In addition to this partnership, World Relief Durham also has a community engagement team to help support refugees' mental health. The group focuses on cultural competency training for volunteers to build supportive friendships with refugees and immigrants to combat the social isolation that refugees face. Though the Triangle is among the larger areas across the country welcoming refugees, people in Charlotte are also aiming to help. After Amara Ghani held a Friendsgiving get-together in 2017, she wanted to do something for refugees from Syria. Her small act of service turned into a nonprofit organization called Welcome Home Charlotte to serve new refugees in Charlotte. Ghani works full-time at Bank of America, but says Welcome Home is her 24/7 job. The main programs include an English language program, a food bank where volunteers can donate food, and an appointment program where volunteers take families to appointments. Connie says, I never intended, and I don't think any board members really intended, that it would reach what it has reached. We are very grateful and overwhelmed with the support, so now we know there's a community behind us, which is great, because that means that we can fall back, and we can have a community that's going to support us. Welcome Home also has seen the need for mental health access. Connie said, right now, we're in the works of connecting our refugee families to those mental health services as well. There's nothing completely set in stone, but if there are people out there who are licensed therapists or psychiatrists or are under that mental health field, we would love to hear from them. We will love to partner up with them because we definitely have a scarcity in that section, for sure. This story was originally published online at NC Health News. Another article by Jasmine Gallup called Practical Civics. Activists and nonprofit groups are working to make voting easier and more accessible for North Carolina's residents. Curtis Shannon Jr., a 20-year-old student in Greensboro, has never taken the right to vote for granted. As soon as he turned 18, he started going to the polls. Shannon, now a junior at North Carolina A&T State, started voting because of the discrimination and injustice he experienced growing up in Lima, Ohio. One of the young man, black man's earliest memories is of his parents being pulled over by the police. Later, when Shannon was 17, he was handcuffed in the driveway of his home. Police falsely identified the teenager as a much older black man seen leaving a, quote, known drug area. And he says, they pulled me out of my car, put me in handcuffs, said I was a danger to myself. I sat in the back of a police car for 2 or 3 hours before they let me go to my mom. Until his encounter with the police, Shannon wanted to be an orthodontist, he told the Indy. Afterward, he turned his attention to pre-law. It was fear and frustration that led Shannon to become an activist, championing the right to vote. And he says, there's so much that's out of control. Change starts locally. Anything you see in your local government, we have the power to control. Disproportionate sentencing, we can change that by the vote because we're electing judges, mayors, city officials. Voting, however, isn't always easy, especially in North Carolina. As soon as black men were given the right to vote in 1870, white people in power started pushing back. In the wake of the 15th Amendment, North Carolina and other states passed a series of laws designed to prevent black people from voting. Poll taxes, felony disenfranchisement, and literacy tests, a provision still included in the North Carolina Constitution today, despite the fact that it is unenforceable. The Jim Crow era lasted almost a century until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed. North Carolina's legacy of voter suppression, however, is far from over, says LaMisha Whittington, deputy director for nonprofit Advance Carolina. Whittington says, if those Jim Crow tactics are still being used and still working, it's not history. The very Supreme Court cases that were supposed to alleviate burdens, like literacy, are still under attack in 2021. This year alone, five bills were introduced in the Republican-led state legislature to make it more difficult for people, particularly people of color, to vote. One law, if enacted, would prohibit local election administrators from accepting much-needed private donations, limiting the money available for voter education. Another would likely purge some naturalized citizens from voter rolls. The cohort of voter suppression bills also includes the deceptively named Elections Integrity Act, or House Bill 259, which lessens the time available to request and return absentee ballots, making it harder to vote by mail. Under the law, people would only have 1 week before Election Day, not two, to request a mail-in ballot. The bill also eliminates the three-day grace period, requiring mail-in ballots to be received by 5 p.m. on Election Day. According to the Bremen Center for Justice, HB 259 is, quote, part of a nationwide GOP-led backlash to robust turnout by black, brown, and indigenous voters in 2020, often credited for Donald Trump's loss. Nearly one in five North Carolinians cast their vote by mail in that election. If HB 259 had been in place, more than 31,000 of those ballots would have been rejected, found a study by Western Carolina University. Whittington says, with such a big push to keep black people out of elections, it often feels like you're running against the tide. Each new law that limits hours at polling places, removes early voting days, or purges names from voter rolls erodes the right to vote a little more, says Dustin Chikorell-Bayard, communications director for the ACLU of North Carolina. He told the Indy, taking the laws one by one, it's easy to dismiss or not fully account for the impacts the policies will have as a whole. But when you put all those things together, it paints a pretty clear picture that North Carolinians' right to vote is constantly under threat. For Chikorell-Bayard, the best win for voting rights would be the creation of fair and equal congressional maps. The redistricting that occurs every 10 years has historically been hijacked by party leaders, most recently Republicans, who divide voters so they can stay in power. Racial and partisan gerrymandering makes it harder for voters to hold election officials accountable, says Chikorell-Bayard. Far too often, the outcome of elections is determined far before a single vote is cast. Preserving the right to vote doesn't necessarily require big policy changes, however. Removing small, bureaucratic barriers to voting can also have a big impact, says Carolyn Fry, the interim advocacy director for Democracy NC. Submitting a mail-in ballot, for example, is currently a multi-step process. People have to request a ballot, check their mailbox, and find two people to witness their vote before they mail the ballot back. Fry says it's all these little hoops you have to jump through in order to vote. These are the things we can really be working on, and in some cases, they are small changes that would have a huge impact on the number of voters who are turning out for elections. Democracy NC is calling for the state to make voting by mail easier by eliminating the witness requirement, offering paid postage for mail-in ballots, and installing secure drop boxes for returning the ballots. North Carolina is one of only 10 states that forbids counties from offering drop boxes for ballots, according to Fry. The nonprofit is also asking that voters be allowed to pick up their mail ballots in person and opt in to mail-in voting for future elections instead of requesting a new ballot form each time, as well as asking to lengthen the window for mail-in voting. There are dozens of other policy changes that state legislature could enact to make voting easier. Fry says, for people who work two or three jobs, it can be difficult to get to the polls. Creating additional days of early voting on weekends is one of the recommendations from Democracy NC. They also suggest allow counties to set flexible voting hours and increase the number of early voting sites based on population. Registering to vote can also be a challenge, says Fry. North Carolina now allows people to register online, but only those with a driver's license or ID. The state should open online registration to everyone, including those who may be homeless or without a car, according to the nonprofit. North Carolina could create automatic voter registration, like 20 other states, or allow people to register or update their registration on Election Day, like 18 other states and the District of Columbia. Ultimately, legislatures should do everything they can to make voting more accessible, including making Election Day a state holiday and creating a new funding source for elections, says Fry. And Fry told the Indy precincts are being consolidated because of a lack of funding. State legislatures swear up and down, our elections are 100% appropriately funded. But if you actually listen to the conversation that's happening at the County Board of Elections level, that's not the case. In the meantime, Whittington and others will keep encouraging people to vote. Kate Fellman, founder of the nonprofit You Can Vote, is working to empower voters by recruiting voting ambassadors like Shannon, that young student activist. Helping new voters establish a voting habit is key to widespread participation in elections, says Fellman. Quote, the biggest indicator of future voting is voting. If we can get folks to vote in all four elections through 2024, they will all be voters for life. The nonprofit focuses on educating new voters and those who may not know they're eligible, like people who have been incarcerated and don't know they have the right to go to the polls. Volunteers answer basic but important questions like, when's the next election? Where do I vote? How do I register? The number one thing on Fellman's wish list is a practical civics class for high school students where they learn about how to exercise their right to vote. Instead, Fellman's nonprofit is filling that role, teaching new voters about what's on their ballot and the steps they need to stay registered. The nonprofit is also working to correct myths around election, Fellman says. Narratives that your vote doesn't matter or that you're not qualified are false. Fellman says the voters who show up decide the elections. If people hear no one votes in this, they think, why should I bother? You might not care about this candidate, but what you care about in your community is on your ballot. Clean drinking water, non-discrimination policies, affordable housing, these are all things young people are concerned about. They need to know that the way to get better community outcomes is by electing leaders who will really represent their vision for the future. The cover story from Indie Week is all about, let's just say, spirits. Liquor, that is. Will HB 890 help bring North Carolina's old-fashioned liquor laws out of the past? You're on vacation in another state. Let's call it Dearth Carolina. On the last day of the trip, you wake up craving something hot and greasy. Bleary-eyed, you type, breakfast near me open now, into Google, landing on a local fried chicken joint with rave reviews. At the restaurant, you're presented with a buffet of greasy goodness, and you decide you'll surprise your sleeping partner by bringing back a fried chicken smorgasbord, tenders, biscuits, maybe even a Cobb salad. You're two to-go boxes deep when an employee comes up and yanks the tongs out of your hand. You can look and smell, but you can't touch. Are you from out of town? You nod. It's Sunday, he said. We can't sell fried chicken on Sundays. Then why are you even open? He walks into the kitchen and returns with a small paper cup. You can have one quarter of a chicken nugget, he says. After you finish it, I can give you another one, but you should take it slow. These nuggets can sneak up on you. Wouldn't want you falling asleep behind the wheel. You didn't plan to eat here, you tell him. You were hoping to bring a meal back for your wife. Sorry, he says, gesturing vaguely. It's the law. Okay, should I just go to Chick-fil-A or whatever that place is called? Chick-fil-A, he laughs, wiping his eyes. That's a good one. If that allegory was too opaque, here's the spark notes. The fried chicken joint is an independent North Carolina distillery. The buffet is bottled liquor. The quarter chicken nugget is a cocktail. Chick-fil-A is an ABC store. And though I doubt that old Raleigh distillery owner Brendan McCraney would ever laugh in a customer's face here, for symbolic purposes, he is the employee, primarily because he, too, is well acquainted with having to tell customers that he can't sell them his product. Or he was until a month ago, when Governor Roy Cooper signed the landmark House Bill 890 into law. That loosens state liquor restrictions in a number of ways, but for McCraney, whose distillery occupies a 10,000-square-foot building in downtown Zebulon, one key provision stands out. Locally owned distilleries can now sell bottled spirits on Sundays. 3 weeks before the bill passed, on a Sunday in September, McCraney manned his distillery's bar from open to close. During that one day, he had to turn away 12 different customers who came in looking to buy a bottle of bourbon. A bottle of bourbon. I haven't had any. That translates to about $1,100 in sales. They left empty-handed and disappointed, and there was nothing I could do about it. As an alternative, he had offered to sell them cocktails. Ever since House Bill 290 passed in 2019, distilleries have been allowed to sell mixed drinks on their premises, which is why many distilleries are open for business on Sunday. But most customers were out-of-towners with long drives ahead. They wanted to buy a bottle, McCraney says, get home and drink responsibly. I have only about 15 seconds just left to say that when distilleries began selling spirits on Sunday, October 3rd, it was the first time in over a century. The Sunday sales allowance also comes with a bonus for independent distillers. It doesn't apply to ABC stores, thus giving local businesses a boost over their state-controlled counterparts. Furthermore, local distilleries are now able to sell bottled spirits on 5 holidays that ABC stores are closed on, including Thanksgiving and the 4th of July. Chris Powers, co-owner of Young Hearts Distilling in downtown Raleigh, how many times have you been stuck in a pickle where you want to go celebrate a holiday, but you don't make it to the store in time, and then you don't have the spirits to do it? Now you can. Well, our entertainers from Planet Squisk are preparing to dematerialize, and their expressions, best as I can tell, say, pay us and sign off. So I have to curtail my article reading today from Indie Week. And you can find replays of this Indie Week broadcast and many of our other shows on our website, ncreadingservice.org. John Fetterson invites you back in 1 week for the next issue. Thanks for listening. Bye.